Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Bruce Fenton. Bruce Fenton is an ancient mysteries researcher, lifelong experiencer of supernormal activity, and an ETI contactee. He has appeared on many radio shows, featured on Science Channel, and is the co-author of four books, including Hybrid Humans, Scientific Evidence of Our 800,000-Year-Old Alien Legacy. Bruce's websites are brucefenton.info, earthforall.net, that's earth, the numeral four, all.net, and hybridhumans.net. So without any further ado, Bruce Fenton, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you so much, James. I really appreciate you having me back on. Looking forward to this.
Yes, we talked a bit prior to the show today about the critical importance of this particular case. Because, and you're going to go into detail about it, but I just want to kind of prep the listeners to what we're going to be talking about. There is this notion amongst a lot of the starry-eyed New Agers out there that all ETs, a blanket statement, all ETs are of necessity, warm and fuzzy, they're here to spiritually uplift us, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in actual fact, this cosmos and perhaps large chunks of this multiverse, it can be interpreted or described as a conflict zone where one or more competing groups vie with each other for supremacy, hegemony, or just outright survival. And what Bruce is going to be talking about is an important case which needs to be brought into mass consciousness about dozens of people who share past life memories of being ETs that were involved in a high-level parlay, a high-level diplomatic meeting with the Draco Reptilian faction, and the outcome of that, and how it affected their karma, and how it affected their future incarnations. So without any further ado, Bruce, please tell the listeners a bit about yourself, and then go right into what we're going to be talking about.
Sure. I mean, I appreciate that intro. Anyone that doesn't know our backstory, basically, myself and my wife Daniela, we've had extensive contacts with beings, both extraterrestrial, dead people, clearly, but the full range, all the weirdness has been thrown at us over the years. But one trail that has emerged from all that is this particular case, which is that basically going back almost 800,000 years ago, there was an event which happened. We're going to go into more detail, but where I connect into this is back in 2003, I had my own kind of past life memory experience during a shamanic journey. I found myself suddenly this extraterrestrial being, very tall, wearing this tight-fitting blue uniform, not humanoid, but not human, not too far removed, piloting a small ship down towards the Earth. I was aware that there was pursuing vessels. And I was also aware, deeply aware, that a lot of people on my side had just been killed. There was a lot of intense knowing, So at the time, I had nowhere to put that in terms of a framework. We come back to 2003, where it was just, another strange experience in a list of strange experiences, right? But I had no context. So this is years and years later. I connected with Daniela, and that was really, we only first met physically in 2011. We met online 2005, 2006. But yeah, when we connected, we realized that, there was something deep there between us. And that seems to have activated a lot of stored memories and also, for her, a whole new set of paranormal events, which included a type of abduction, I suppose, but, not your physical body, but her consciousness being taken, her awareness being taken by these beings and thrown into a setting, which seems to be the remote past in the Mayan civilization. Palenque, which most people will know from Eric von Daniken's books, Palenque with Pakal, and the lid, the famous lid, which looks like Pakal is piloting a small ship. She would find herself living there, and this is like two, three times a week for a year. She would be going through these experiences of finding herself in this place. We don't know if it's the actual place or a virtual reality construct. Obviously, there's a, we're open-minded about these things. We realize you have to be careful putting an absolute, authority on that, exactly what it is. It's a very vivid, very real experience. At this site, there were Pleiadians, there were tall greys underneath the city. there were these hybrid Pleiadians that were running the city. And in another area under the city, she saw what looked like a cross between humans and reptilians. You know, so you've got this complex of politics going on that you, people report elsewhere, also on board ships where they see different beings, they see different interactions. You know, there's seems to be at times treaties or, alliances or wars, depending on what time, what place. And that linked us into this story. And that's how really we got involved with the case we're going to talk about, is that through this experience, somebody heard about, our material we were sharing, and they connected us with this this story in Australia, and eventually onto, Valerie Barrow and her work, which I'm also going to talk about, and, realized that there was this intrinsic link, not only between the beings, but my personal experience of being on the craft and coming down. So that's kind of how we tie into it. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. And in a nutshell, can you describe to the listeners the gist of Valerie Barrow's book? I forget the exact title. Alcoringa is in it, which is some kind of ancient divine kind of aboriginal stone. But it all ties into this ancestral ET karmic ancestry.
It does, yeah. I mean, it's called, the other part of the title is When the First Ancestors Were Created. So if anyone wants to check that book out. And just for anyone who's not aware, the Alcoringa is a word used to represent the time before time, and when humans were created, when many of the animals were created, even features in the landscape. It's used by a number of nations within the Australasian continent. I think largely central north and the north. There's a few different groups there that use that term, or very closely related terms. And that they have these objects which are called, usually called Churinga stones. And in this particular case, one of these Churinga stones makes its way to Valerie Barrow, to her home, which is also called Alcoringa, right? So there's a flow of synchronicity, as there often is in these cases, in the same way that we've become connected to it through synchronicities. And she found herself being, proffered this object by a lady that said, look, can you look after it? I feel you're meant to look after it because of the name of your house, because you're, a spiritual medium. It seems like it's meant to go to you while I go and recover from this serious illness I have, and then I will return for it and, take it onwards back to the tribal group who should be looking after it, the way it's come from originally. So this is how this object ends up there. Now, to talk a little bit about the object, because this is important. Although most Alcoringa stones are ancient, but fairly recent. When I say ancient, that there's what they call copies of older ones. They're very sacred, but there's an understanding that some of these go back right to this time before time. There's a few, really legendary sacred ones. Right now, obviously, my belief, and people will make up their own minds, but is that this one is clearly one of the very ancient original ones. And the reason for that is that no sooner has it come to her home than she starts having a communication with a consciousness that is uploaded into this device. And I'm going to call it a device because it explains to her that it's been brought to her by an extraterrestrial group in that creation time. And this matches again with what the Aboriginals say, because they say that these original stones, right, contain an aspect of the consciousness of the Alcoringa ancient beings, right, that lived in that dream time. So, I mean, you've got an absolute parallel. This is we're not talking about something out of context here. This is what the Aboriginal elders would actually expect, that this being would be in the device or in the stone, and you can call it sacred stone, alien device, technology device. It depends on which modality you're coming from, of course. And I think both of those statements would be true, and obviously I believe all of these things in a way are on two levels, spiritual level and the way that we see things in our culture, perhaps, and in the modern dominator culture. So for anyone who's more comfortable with it being an alien technology, others will be more comfortable being a spiritual object. I don't mind how people interpret that. But put it this way, there is a consciousness in the object which is able to share information. That's the key bit, right? And it knows things that have happened from before humans were on this planet. It's been recording this information the whole time, and is able to replay it through a psychic mechanism and directly load it into your head. And this is what Valerie experiences, a sort of download from the consciousness of the artifact, in which it gives her this whole lost history of a mission which has come from the Pleiades, but is a mission involving species, multiple species. It's not a simple story. We're talking to people about Pleiadians, you know, and I would just, on a slight side tangent there, say when I talk about Pleiadians, I usually include the word alliance, because it is a Pleiadian alliance of many beings, you know. When you hear the New Age version, you know that the Pleiadians are all from the planet Alcyone. Also, take that with a huge handful of salt, because that story never stacks up, right? What we actually have here is a mission that launches from the Pleiades, where there is a wormhole gateway, but the beings have come from all over the place. They come through. They've made this agreement, as you alluded to at the beginning, that they will have basically a transfer of the planet Earth from Draco Alliance, Draco Horde, as I like to refer to them, because they're not kind of a horde, and that they will pass on this planet back to this Alliance control peacefully in the agreement, and that they will then leave. You know, this has been negotiated by species which exist, which have relationships with both, you know, parties. Very complex, you know, involving, you know, all sorts of beings, not just physical beings, non-physical beings, beings that inhabit crystal planets, you know, all sorts of strangeness that people will likely struggle to get their heads around. You know, maybe not your audience, but, you know, obviously most of the planet will struggle with this. But they've had these high-level meetings, and then in the end, there is a betrayal of the mission. I'll leave that word in edgeways there. Go on and on.
Yes. Excuse me. the betrayal was the outcome of this high-level diplomatic meeting. And Valerie goes into detail about this in her book. And before I go any further, I'd also like to bring up another point of probable, perhaps, corroboration with Daniela's Mayan Palladian memories. There's another book out there. I forget the exact title, Winter Song, Winter Something. And it talks about a similar thing where a woman, a North American woman, was spending time in South America, and for whatever reason, she started having all these flashbacks of being an ET that inhabited an underground base somewhere in the Andes, and the conflict that they had with other ET races. And part of the outcome of that was this war, which resulted in the desertification, if that's the word, of the American Southwest. Apparently, it was pretty verdant at one time, but then this conflict ensued. And then, you know, large parts of it were reduced to what we now know as the desert southwest of America. But getting back to Valerie Barrow's book, and it must be understood, dear listeners, that we're not just talking about two or three people that have memories of large parts of this experience, the saga, or bits and pieces of it. We're talking about dozens of people from all walks of life who have memories of being different ETs that were part of this. Could you describe what Valerie mentioned when this huge ship came from the Pleiades system, loaded up with all these ETs? It was a large crystalline type ship, and you know, subsequent to the meeting of the reptilians and the fatal outcome of that.
Yeah, I mean, what happened is essentially that you have I have to describe the ship briefly, because this is going to be really important when I come to the bit where I say that we have objective proof of this story. The ship is very large. It carries approximately 50,000 mixed beings. It is grown from crystal. It's not made, you know, there's no rivets, bolts, or anything like that. This is not human-level technology. This is a crystal, largely crystal vessel grown from living crystal, right, which has an artificial intelligence inhabiting the crystal of the structure itself, i.e. we have a living ship. And I know that people out there, they'll be aware that there are reports of people who've been abducted and they've had the uncanny feeling the ship itself is alive, right? And there's a few accounts out there. And that is a valid feeling, because many of these ships are alive. And this craft is able to modify itself, change shape, do all sorts of strange stuff, right? You've got to consider as well that it's only when it arrives here that it really enters not only our space, but our level of vibration, our, you know, our dimension, if you like. So this is a very strange craft with a very strange crew. But yes, you have a craft that's about, from what I understand, about a kilometer diameter. You know, it's pretty big. I'm going to add that it's not enormous in the scale of some of the ships that are out there. There's some really frighteningly large crafts moving around out there, but it's big, you know, kilometer diameter, 50,000 beings. So, you know, we're talking about pretty big colony ship. there is this agreement in place that, yeah, that they will arrive. There'll be a sort of a handover ceremony. The occupying force is a group of, you know, reptilians that have a link to the Orion system. There have been other beings on this planet, including a reptoid group, obviously another kind of lizard-like group, who are mentioned in the memories. But the predominant control group is these reptilians, right, which are the more upstanding crocodile-like kind of beings, a bit more like that. The others being more described as being more toad-like, more frog-like features, you know, so if people want to sort of get an image of the difference between the two. These beings are channeling Draco controllers. You know, there's certain ones among them, the equivalents of, you know, shamans or, you know, priests, who bring in that energy of the Draco, who have created them in the distant past. And they in turn have created early hominins on the planet, which they use as a kind of a slave race slash offerings for these Draco, who like to munch on a bit of consciousness now. Again, they're horrific. You know, if you want a parallel of religious beliefs in a satanic-like figure, you'll be hard-pressed to find a better one than the Draco. You know, these are multidimensional entities that, you know, consume consciousness of other beings. So, I mean, horrific creatures. Well, I don't know on creatures. Horrific things. So there is this agreement in place. However, there's whisperings in the ears of some of those involved to not go ahead with this deal and to simply betray the mission and destroy it. And that is what happens. There is an ambush on the ship. There's a betrayal from within. The shields are lowered. And then they open fire on this craft using a kind of electromagnetic vibrational weaponry. What happens is it resonates the molecular structure at a point where the right frequency will literally pull apart the molecules and melt the vessel. You know, so it's like a super high temperature, literally being brought apart at the molecular level, almost a melting. So it's a very specific way it's destroyed. Again, this is kind of important later. A few ships manage to come down. I'm not sure the exact numbers. In the book, it's about 3. But if you read between the lines, there's a description in the book of an underground base that's already being loaded with, like front loaded with equipment by some on board who seem to know there's going to be a betrayal. So although that's not fully clarified in the text, anyone who reads the book will have that in the back of their head. They'll think, yeah, that's a bit strange, because that is sort of disconnected from the survivors. It seems there's already at least some of these alliance have come down, created a base under the sea in a cavern system where you literally sort of fly through the ocean and then into a cavern system and have front loaded it. So we don't really know how many ships and how many beings have already gone into there and they're running this secret clandestine breakaway program from the rest of the ship. But the actual survivors from the ambush, the direct ambush, seems to be not more than a few ships, you know, certainly with 3 of them coming down in Australia, one of those going into the water at Broken Bay, and the other 2 sort of, you know, landing nearby and helping pull survivors out of the water, as is described. Valerie not only gets this story told to her directly by the artifact, but it tells her that, look, you're going to have all these people validate this story by bringing little bits of it to you, you know, in different situations. So she gets it, you know, it's sort of strange, you know, it does it in a way where you can't feel that, you know, you're just hearing a voice and you know, you've gone mad or something. It wants it independently validated to her. So it somehow activates all these people with these memories, and they start to come into her life, you know, either through her professional work as a regression therapist, which obviously is, again, synchronicity, you know, as a person who's in a situation who would encounter people who might want to be regressed with strange memories. But she also finds that people just turn up. You know, she has someone in a car park at a shopping center that comes up to her and wants to, you know, get in the car and tell her something, and then starts talking about, you know, elements of this story of this ship being blown up. So, you know, it's not as simple as someone saying, well, aha, you know, she's regressing people and making them remember it. No, you know, this is really strange. You know, it's involving people who really have nothing to do with her, but will just start telling her. A number of them say, you know, afterwards, look, we don't know if this is real. Maybe we just made it up. Others are very sure that, you know, it is a past life. So there's a real mixed bag of people involved in this. But they all together tell the same story that Al Tjeringa has told her, you know, through this telepathic communication.
And when these beings that were on the ambush ship escaped, I'm thinking like escape pods or smaller craft to get away before the ultimate destruction of the craft. Then yep. They had to forge an existence, and for them was a harsh environment. Did you want to talk about how they decided to, you know, band together the survivors, survive, and create future generations of themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. because the original mission of this ship, which is named as the Rexogena, right? And again, I'm going to just a side note to that, that the word we use today, exogenesis, which means basically life from space, right? That's an echo back to the name of the ship that actually did bring sort of life from space, the Rexogena. You know, we get things like the word gene, you know, exogenesis and genesis. And so these are echoes in consciousness. I'd add that for people. But anyway, you know, what happens is you have this mission that they will, you know, modify themselves using their genetic technologies to be able to live on this planet. And even at the beginning of the mission, there is a discussion at the higher levels that this is maybe a bad idea, and that, you know, perhaps there's a better way of doing this, that they could travel in consciousness only to this system. But they decide, you know, no, we want to do this sort of almost like the old-fashioned way. We're going to colonize the planet, physically go there, modify our bodies so we can live on this sort of harsh world, start to bring this occupied planet back into the sort of the light, out of this Draco influence, and use it as a bridgehead into what they consider to be a very negative part of the cosmos, which I know a lot of people might not want to hear that, but it is considered that we are in, you know, occupied Draco space, and that this is really, you know, a bridgehead for the Alliance to start almost doing what we'd have to call missionary work, you know, coming in to try and raise up the vibration or the, you know, the energy of this sector. But what they find, though, is once this ship is destroyed, that they've lost most of the technology that they rely on to do this. So all of a sudden, they're on a hostile planet where they can hardly, most of them, you know, can hardly breathe. Some can't breathe. Others find, you know, that they're dealing with radiation problems. The sunlight is too bright for their skin. There's issues with microbes in the water and in the air, you know, struggles to eat the food, you know, and again, they've got not much technology. They've got a few bits and bobs that have survived in these smaller, like saucer craft, you know, typical kind of saucer craft. They've come down, you know, and there's a small number of beings in this group that have landed in Australia, perhaps 100, that have managed to get safely to, you know, to this site near Gosford, where they've landed, where the glyphs are, which is very near to there. And so what they realize is that there's no real way they're going to manage long-term survival. They're not going to be able to colonize a hostile planet with, you know, a handful of them, hardly any technology, you know, not enough tech to do the necessary alterations to all these different types of beings, and, you know, a really complex situation. So what they recognize is that, well, there's still an opportunity here to make a difference to the greater plan, which is to try and bring Earth, you know, into this Alliance collective. So instead, they go to a plan B. And plan B is to take the existing hominins, which have been created by the reptilians, and start to modify them, because they already have the ability to live on the planet. To upgrade them, you know, give them a better brain, better system, you know, and also to imbue a part of these star beings into them, you know, some aspects of their own, you know, genetics and their energies into this new being. And so that becomes, yeah, the default plan, although it's not the original plan.
Yes, and if memory serves, part of that process also involved at least some of them volunteering to incarnate into these successive generations. So there would be, mm-hmm. you know, this conscious institutional memory, so to speak, of who yes. they were and then their origins.
Yeah, and that's really important, because if you think about it, if you're going to do a selective breeding project, you know, if you have mice or you have flies, like we use these in modern day experiments for the reason that you can witness and control the breeding of many generations of those creatures, right? Because obviously flies and mice, they can reproduce over a short period of time, and you can see where the generations are going, and you can shepherd that experiment along. Now that's a problem when you're trying to do this with humans. Obviously they live, you know, a relatively long time. Now, even though these extraterrestrials, many of them have lifespans should be longer than ours, you know, they're in a hostile environment, you know, they're just doing their best to survive. They realize they're not going to physically be here for the full duration of this experiment. So what they decide instead is, well, hang on a minute, you know, we can use our ability to direct our incarnations, which many star beings can do and still do and are doing right now to Earth humans. So they decide to put themselves into these new beings and therefore be within the experiment itself. Now, this is very clever because, of course, then they can continue to direct this for as long as they're able to recall memories. And obviously between each other, they can remind each other, even as they begin to forget, which is a process in reincarnation, obviously, on this planet. We know that it's very difficult for people to remember reincarnational memories unless you do a lot of advanced meditations. I mean, we can see an example. If you go to the Tibetan Lamas, those people, you know, some of them are flat out, you know, they're working on intense higher meditations, right? And they will be able to incarnate into somebody, you know, their next life and choose all the specifics. They can even tell the other, you know, the other monks, they say, look, I'll be born under a rainbow on the first day of, you know, May in the village over there. Look for me, you know, bring my stuff over there and I'll identify it. And, that, and that's the process of recognizing what's called tulkus, which is these, you know, incarnate lamas. And they'll go there, they'll take the clothes, you know, the pipe, the hat or whatever, and they'll show it to the prospective children. And the real one will, generally speaking, identify all of the objects of their past life and be able to recite complex Buddhist, you know, scriptures from memory. You know, it's like maybe four-year-old, three-year-old children, you know, coming out with, you know, complex, you know, ancient scrolls. You know, so this is something that still happens. This happens and people go away and look into the subject of tulkus and find that, you know, I'm not pulling this out nowhere. They can go and look at this themselves. So these beings, just like those masters, are able to do this. They're able to choose their incarnations. So they keep coming back into these human forms, directing the experiment. And they form, through this process, they're able to choose selectively, you know, which groups breed with which groups, put the head towards what we call, you know, the ideal human. So that's what they're shepherding this all towards. Now, there's a few different kinds of humans that come out of this. And this you should expect when you think about it. You think, well, you're doing an experiment and you're modifying, you know, these humans and you're not got all the technology you wanted. You know, you've not got the absolute overview where it's going. You're doing your best with it. You're going to have some that don't work out and you're going to have some that are different to others. And that's exactly what is described. You know, there's some freaks that are born and some of these don't survive. And also, as we go forward in the experiment, we see, of course, the arrival of a few different kinds of humans, Denisovans, Neanderthals, you know, modern humans, others that disappeared, Red Gear Cave. There's the, obviously now we've got the little people in Flores, Homo Florentiensis. But all of these start coming, you know, we'll start getting these lines that are heading towards all of these, right? And this is only from this period, sort of close to 800,000 years ago. Before that, you've got Homo erectus, okay? Homo erectus is all over the world. For over a million years, yeah, Homo erectus is just about the only guy on the block. And it doesn't change much in that period. There's no great leap forward. There's no great acceleration in the brain. There's no explosion of different kinds of humans. So already you have a very strange anomaly here where after around about 800,000 years ago, you start to have all these lines splitting off as though someone's carrying out breeding experiments, right? Creating new bloodlines and stuff, yeah? So you've got absolute matches in the fossil record in all the things that we know in science with what we expect to see in these kinds of experiments. So we can. So this is basically what they do. And they go through for as long as they can, remembering. And then eventually those memories become more and more clouded as they become more human and have spent more and more time here until it's very difficult to remember huge amounts of the, you know, the data that they came with. And as we see today, you know, it takes perhaps special nudging to awaken these people. And that's what's happened in this case, is a special nudging from the consciousness of this artifact, this piece of technology, whatever it is. It seems to have awakened, you know, and nudged all these people to wake up and give their accounts.
And in your particular experience, you remember yourself being in a small craft, you were being pursued. Mm-hmm. Was Daniela part of that equation too? Did she share that Rexagena experience with you?
She hasn't directly remembered in the way that I've seen a visual, you know, a visual past life experience, you know, where I'm fully immersed in it. My conviction is she was part of it. She feels that she was part of it. And with the experiences she's had as what's clearly a Plidian hybrid in Palenque, another link she's had, experiences she's had to do with ancient Egypt. You know, I can't say that she's had those experiences. Yeah, but certainly it's enough there that would convince us that she's part of that story. I consider her to be my twin flame. It's even possible that at the time we were the same person, quite honestly. You know, we consider each other to be, you know, aspects of the same soul. So even, you know, I mean, even if she wasn't there in some respect, if I was there, she was there. So that's the way I would look at that, is that I don't know if we were there separately or together, but if either one of us is involved in it, we're both involved because we seem to always share that connection through our lives. Indeed, in Palenque, where she's been taking these experiences, she sees me there. She sees that I'm the war chief of Palenque, you know, and she's married to me in the 7th century in Palenque. So we tend to be there, you know, with each other through these strange past life experiences. So, yeah, I have every reason to believe she was there. Whether she was on the ship with me, I don't know. My recall of that is it seemed to be me on my own piloting a ship, but I'm not sure whether there was other people in another section of that ship and I'm just piloting it. You know what I mean? So that bit remains unclear. And I don't remember landing. So again, I don't say that, oh yeah, I have this clear recall of the whole flow of it. I just have a snippet. You know, it's quite possible that there was others on board this little ship, you know, or whatever. So until I regain more of that, I can't say. What I have instead is impressions of things, that she also has impressions of things about that time. So not as clear as a full past life recall, but certainly information that seems to bubble up and fits into this, you know, this account. So that's how I would put that.
I think it would be a good time at this point to segue into, you know, as a lead up in the second segment, some of the experiences that you and Daniela had, where it seemed, if memory serves, I'm trying to remember a part of your story, that there were aspects of yourself coming from these previous times, the Palladian aspects of yourself, that were basically in communication with your present selves, and you were kind of learning and remembering as you went along, and this kind of formed the framework of remembering your, in Daniela's case, her Mayan existence in that part of the world. And also there was a tie-in with ancient Egypt, like you alluded to earlier. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different things that happened to me. For example, before I physically, you know, met Daniela, again, she was having a lot of experiences. One of them was that she would have quite regular visits from a being best known as Akhenaten. But Akhenaten was quite clearly an extraterrestrial in these experiences, and was adamant that she was a relative of his in that life in Egypt. And that not only that, but they'd been involved in a special project which was to do with regrowing limbs of people who had lost their limbs, and that they were using some kind of knowledge that was available at the time to do this. And so he used to talk to her about all these kind of things and telling her that, you know, she was part of this, you know, this backstory of, I guess, extraterrestrial involvement in prehistory. So she's had other experiences where she's been shown areas under Egypt in the tunnel systems, you know, at night, where she's been taken there, and beings underneath telling her that when, you know, when things hit the fan, that if we need to, we can come down underneath under Egypt and into their tunnel systems. And, you know, so strange things like that that she's had that connect to that. We firmly believe that there's still a lost civilization under Egypt down in those tunnel systems, to be quite frank. And that also, yeah, in the Mayan life, as I say, she sees me there. Not just me, she's seen other people that we kind of know from this life. But that, yeah, I'm married to her, so that's been a bit of a trigger. The fact that we had that shared life there and that she's had the direct communication with that life. I've had one experience, and that was back in 2002, where I suddenly found myself flying over, you know, 1 minute sitting in my chair, another minute out of body experience, flying over a jungle, seeing a white stepped pyramid, but like brand new, you know, so not how they look now, gray and falling down, and seeing a guy on top of the pyramid, and, you know, getting a certain download of information from that, knowing that there was a secret tunnel there, knowing that there's a village nearby, and all this stuff that came into my mind. I mean, it's only later I put that together and realized that initially, these beings have tried to connect me with this information. Something went a bit wrong, and they've clarified this a little bit late, like when I connected with Daniela, that, you know, there was this attempt. And then after that, they've defaulted to her as the stronger connection of the two of us. Hence, she's been taken there multiple times, and I've had this one abortive, you know, connection where they pulled me in, it didn't quite work, and then they've gone to her. But this connection, yeah, certainly has provided a huge amount of information, particularly about the beings, you know, because, of course, she's living it like we're sitting now, you know, in our chairs talking. For her, it's just as vividly real, if not more real, that she's there living it as this lady, you know, in the Mayan elite of Palenque, going around the city, you know, married to me, seeing her children, seeing, you know, talking to me, having arguments with me, all sorts of, you know, day-to-day living your life in a separate reality. So, I mean, there's a profound effects on her, as you can try and, you know, people try and imagine living these two lives. But also there, she's being shown underground areas where there's records, there's got emerald tablets, you know, like, you know, obviously about the emerald tablet of Thoth, there's emerald tablets, you know, lots of them. There's crystal skulls, which again are storing information. And then there's on the walls all kinds of strange calendrical type, you know, objects, things that if you run your finger on them, you run your finger around, you know, the grooves on them, that you read information as though your finger was, you know, the needle in a record, something like that. That you literally, if you're an extraterrestrial or you have that energy, or you're, you know, maybe if you're a high-level psychic, if you put your finger on these and run it around, it starts to tell you all about sorts of prophetic information, historical information, extraterrestrial constellations. You know, so she's been given a lot of information, a lot of downloads, a lot of really strange stuff, which some of it, you know, she's shared. Some of it, she says, is not until another time it's meant to be shared. But that's unlocked a lot for us, yeah. And of course, these beings have clarified to her, you know, that they're Pleiadians, that the ones are the city of hybrids, but there's occasional visitors who are full Pleiadians. You know, they're bluish-coloured humanoid race who are part of that alliance, and they sometimes come and visit the city. The other hybrids look more like humans, but they're about, you know, they're actually 7-8 foot tall, and you can see that in the artwork at Palenque. If anyone wants to check that out, go to images of the Temple of the Foliated Cross at Palenque and look at the friezes on the wall, and you will see the Lords of Palenque with their helpers, and their helpers are standing on boxes, and they're still head and shoulders shorter than these lords, right? So again, you can validate this. You don't need to just say, oh, take my word for it. Go away. Look what the Mayans have recorded there. Look what they say. Look at the Mayan blue, which they went to this special trouble, inventing a color, Mayan blue, which for years was a mystery how they did it. The Mayan blue was important because the beings, right, are blue, okay? So there's a really important reason. And obviously you see that in Indian art, and you see it elsewhere, but this particular faction, you know, or a slightly bluish color, not necessarily as blue as the colors they used. But if you imagine, let me say, the surface of a pearl, but it's slightly bluish, and that's what they're rather like. Okay, so just for people that wonder what they're like, these are not the tall blondes or what have you. They are distinctly extraterrestrial. You know, so. I'm not trying to go off on a tangent, but if that gives some idea, that's, yeah, there were a lot of the downloads and a lot of the unlocking of this Pleiadian information came out through that and through the direct contacts, you know, that she's had with the beings telling her, you know, these, this and this and this has happened, and they want you to do this, prepare for these changes that are coming. They're giving her downloads about, you know, environmental things that can happen. But I mean, obviously, those are commonplace. Nearly anyone who gets into contact, you know, ends up getting told that there's events ahead, there's environmental problems. You know, that's a common theme, isn't it, when we hear that again and again. But she's, course, had those as well.
Did they elaborate on what those environmental problems would be, and did they suggest perhaps that it may be connected to some kind of celestial event?
Yeah, they did talk about the possibility of, you know, pole shift was one of the things that they were concerned about, and they seemed to think there was a reasonable chance of that. I'm trying to think if they went into some of the other stuff. They certainly talked about major earthquakes, and you know, there's a few other sort of major events. We did sort of initially talk about this, but my feeling is that, you know, timelines changed. I think that at one point there was a timeline, I believe, where around 2012, 2013, there was a strong possibility of some really problematic events, but that the timeline has shifted. And that's why we have a lot of people having these strange, they call the Mandela effect memories. There's people that are remembering things that didn't happen in this timeline, right? That's become really, really common. My feeling and my understanding is that, you know, there was a bit of a timeline merge, and that, you know, we've got off the hook from 2012, 2013, but that these events are not gone. You know, that the things like the galactic core explosion, you know, the outburst of the sun. In fact, that's come up lately. People are talking again about maybe an outburst from the sun coming, which is one of the things that had come up. They talked about the death of the sun and the rebirth of the sun to her. And also they talked about, was it three suns in the sky? I think it was a white sun, a blue sun, and a red sun. That there was a time when the three suns would be in the sky. It's something to do with the twin flames coming back together and certain groups with similar energy coming back together and having to work together to grow plants again, but using energy to grow plants. A real massive, you know, shift in the way things work on this planet. Talking about how the moon had secrets to tell us. Trying to get all of it. There was a whole, when her first one of these experiences, right, she was dragged to a meeting, right? Most of them were in Palenque, right? The first one, she was in what seemed to be a dome-shaped space, right? She now sort of thinks, you know, that could have actually been a craft. It didn't really click, but it was a dome-shaped space, but it didn't clearly have walls. It seemed to be almost like you're in space, but it had a teal kind of color to it. Now, in hindsight, you know, she's realized that, yeah, it could have been a transparent UFO, because obviously some of these seem to go transparent when they're traveling. I think people have experienced that quite a bit. And that there was all sorts of beings there that were largely these giant human type beings, and they would tell, they were the ones that really told all this stuff. The first, you know, abduction, if you like, was where she got the biggest download, and this is where they talked about all of these coming changes. Many of them sounded to me like things you hear in like Hopi prophecy and Mayan prophecy and stuff, but others, yeah, were really strange, to do with energy, you know, vibrational levels, certain numbers they gave to people, like you could be a 5.2 and you would be with other 5.2s, and, you know, so stuff that I don't fully understand. But the bulk of it, yeah, you know, was to do with these earth changes, and also not to let them destroy, if you kept repeating everything, not to let them destroy everything, you know, basically the New World Order, not to let them, you know, win, and that in the end, don't be scared, you know, that we can sort of, you know, get through this. And that was one of the sort of core messages. I will have to dig out the download for you, and I will share that to you, you know, so you have the full text. But yeah, that was the initial kind of, you know, big push. And then after that, yeah, it was these other experiences, which, to be honest, she had so many of them that some of them she wonders, you know, why they are even doing it? Because she didn't always get information. Sometimes she'd just be there, you know, living this life, you know, amongst these hybrids, and then would be back again and, you know, with me again, you know, come back to her body and think, well, what did I actually get out of that? So it's not something where you can say it's a linear and you know, every time you go there, you get some information. You know, she wishes it was, you know, because it's often an unpleasant experience. I mean, she's come back with physical injuries, like black eyes, things like that. So, you know, because there's these tall greys there, and the tall greys are horrific. You know, I would go to the point of saying that they, you know, they're verging onto what people would have to call demonic. She's witnessed them down in the areas underneath the city doing experiments, including stripping the skin from infants, from babies, and using it to grow these fake skins. They want to try and hide themselves as humans. It's like really weird, because I mean, like she said, there's no freaking way that you're going to think that they're a normal person. These like 9 foot tall, you know, tall greys, and that they're trying to grow some sort of artificial skins, but in horrific, you know, like hellscape type experiments with, you know, children. So, I mean, I, you know, that stuff, you know, you don't like to sort of go on about, you know, go on about too much to people, because it's just, you know, A, that it's a struggle for people to accept. And B, it's just so horrific to imagine the things that these beings will do, quite happily, to people. And that, you know, again, parallels with some of the experiences that Dr. T said about on the crafts. You know, the small greys, which are essentially androids, they don't really, you know, do much beyond what they're told to do. But then when you see these others, these sort of big tall greys and the insectoid types, that they're quite sort of, you know, angry at you for being in pain. You know, they'll complain and say, you know, what are you screaming about? You know, we're going to wipe your mind anyway. Stop complaining, sort of thing. You know, so these are, you know, they're thoroughly despicable entities in my view, you know. So that's kind of a tie into this. Again, I know I'm going a little bit off the side of the Outringer thing, but I think it's kind of important that people kind of understand that part of it.
Absolutely, because you touch on a number of key issues, which I'd like you to elaborate on more in the second segment. In the time we got left, I'd just like to point out that as time goes on, it seems that these connections are happening more and more often. I know in my personal experience, my wife, Kylie, and I were meant to be together at this point in time, and mm-hmm. I know that others have gotten together with their significant others. And also, people in, for lack of a better term, a similar soul group that have shared similar experiences, similar incarnations, similar eras, similar context. And mm-hmm. a lot of that has to do with the extraterrestrial hyperdimensional aspect of things too, because, and I say this not in any kind of elitist sense, because some of us have had, I don't think there's any such thing as a mundane incarnation, but you know, some that don't necessarily involve ETs or shamanic existences or being a battle commander or anything like that, because as we know in the not even the not so distant past, eking out an existence here on the surface was a pretty difficult thing to do. So there was always, you know, challenging, trying times. But in other incarnations, some of us were ETs and some of us mm-hmm. were part of that hybrid mix of human hybrids who walked with the gods, if you will, who walked side by side and worked in unison or worked for these extraterrestrials. And, you know, mm-hmm. we think of the Greek mythologies, the Norse mythologies, and the lore from all over the world. So what you're talking about, Bruce, it harkens back to that, all that lore yeah. that all yeah. these cultures on the surface have talked about. Now, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, in the time we got left, Could you talk about a bit about how the, because if I remember correctly, part of Daniela's story was not only was she being taken astrally or hyperdimensionally, whatever the case may be, and sometimes, I guess, physically into these other realms, other dimensions, but correct me if I'm wrong, at times she was there and she was basically part of that culture again. I mean, she looked like them, she dressed like them, she seemed to have this, and I've heard this from other people, a state-dependent memory where she didn't even need to be instructed. She just kind of knew what to do, you know, in certain contexts.
Yeah. Speaking the language, you know, and everything. I mean, I don't sort of share it because it's all kind of a bit weird and private, but we have, you know, I have hours of recordings of her talking in this language, which sounds to me like ancient Mayan, you know, but I can't validate that for sure. And obviously, again, what is ancient Mayan? Is that a language of these gods, right? Because, so, I mean, but she's talking in that language to the, you know, to Pakal and to these other beings. And what I would find is while I'm still in the room, I can hear her mumbling, you know, in this altered state where she's not in the body, but her body obviously is still connected somehow to this, you know. So I would just hear her mumbling sometimes in this language. So I recorded it, you know. So I'm well aware that, you know, she doesn't speak up, you know, that language, you know, in her day to day, right? So as you say, she goes back into that experience. Is able to have, you know, she has a body there that fits the situation. She has the language. She has understandings of what's going on there. All of that, you know, she just slots into this other life. And on one or two occasions, the other her, and this is quite bizarre, but the other her has come into the body and has not fully woken up, but has reached out, you know, touched my face and stuff, and sort of called me by the name she knows me as, which is, it's Cal, and she will. I hear her say, it's cow, and touch my face. It looked really quite weird, you know. And one time she rubbed the side of my face. And afterwards, when Daniela was back, she said she didn't like your beard. And like about 2 days later, my beard died and it didn't grow again for about 6 months. Right? Stuff like that. Wow. You know, you think, what the heck is, yeah, exactly. She literally rubbed the side of my face. She rubbed my beard off with her hand. Right? You know what I mean? That sort of thing. You know, super weirdness. And things with, you know, like I say, with Danny coming back with black eyes, where the greys have tried to grab her in these underground areas, and she's physically had, you know, altercations with them. And like one thing you need to know is actually their weakness is their knees. You know, just for anyone, if you ever are able to, you know, fight back, go for the knees, right? They've got a weak point there. But that's how she would sometimes get away from them, because you kick them in the knees and they go down, right? But she's had, she's come back with black eyes. So bear in mind, in her Pleiadian hybrid body, she's considerably stronger than the average human. So when these fights happen, you know, it's not as though you're fighting the Daniela, you know, here, you know what I mean? She's like a 7 foot tall Pleiadian hybrid, you know, with increased strength, increased psychic abilities, increased speed, you know, so they're the supermen of history. I mean, it's like the giants of old going into battle, right? You know, I would be leading military campaigns. And so I'd have these little Mayan warriors behind me, but I'm this, like, you know, 7.5 foot tall sort of Superman, you know. So obviously, you know, I go into the battle ahead of them. So these legends, again, of these armies that go in with their giant, these are not just fantasy stories, right? These were real battles where, you know, on different sides you have different types of hybrids, and that, you know, we would be kind of the primary warriors that, you know, if you didn't have one on your team, you don't want to be taking one of these guys on, I tell you that much, because, you know, we move at incredible speeds, have, you know, hyper strength, you know, incredible psychic abilities. So these sort of things, again, when you say about the legends, these legends of gods, legends of giants, these are not just coming out of nowhere. You know, they really aren't. And again, you can see these in the sculptures, you can see these in the recordings. They show that they had their, you know, their kind of supermen on teams, right? So that's all part of that as well, you know, that comes out of this hybrid program. And we're all hybrids, and that's one of the key bits, you know, about the new book, obviously, Hybrid Humans, is that this isn't a case of just saying, okay, well, you know, there's a few special people, you know, and as you were saying, to this kind of what sounds sometimes like an elitist thing of I'm special, and a lot of the New Age kind of material, it kind of plays into that, if we're honest. There's that thing of, look, I'm special, I'm an Arcturian, look at me, listen to me, you know, watch me on YouTube, you know, and there's that kind of flavor to that. Right, but let me just clarify, you know, from my perspective, all humans have a legacy, going back to alien genetic engineering, of you know the survivors of the Outer Ring, you know the Outer Ring mission of the affected men. But no, if we've got a bit of time, I'll clarify the evidence for this. How long have we got? Just so I know that I can factor in giving the evidence for some of the modifications and what happened. Have we got a little bit of time to do that?
Yeah. Tell you what, this is probably a good time to go into a break and hold that thought, Bruce, because we're delving into some really important things here. Can you give the listeners your websites again?
Sure. Yeah. If they want to check me out personally, it's brucefenton.info. There's a little bit of an overview, a few blog posts on there. And also my other book they'll find on there, which is more conventional. And then they can go to hybridhumans.net, which is obviously the homepage for this material. And earthforall.net, with the number 4. And that gives a whole wide selection of articles, including guest articles on sort of ancient mysteries and strange things.
And I would definitely second that notion, Bruce, that we are all hybrids to one degree or another. Some of the articles you wrote about the Denisovans are outstanding, I might add, and I encourage the listeners to check that out. One quick note before we sign off this first segment. On board that craft, which was a living crystalline craft, there were a variety of entities, species, as you alluded to. And if memory serves, there was a contingent of line beings on there too. And there's a lot of talk these days about the line beings and whatnot. But this was something that was also corroborated in the Alcaringa story. So anyhow, we reached the end of a fascinating first segment with Bruce Fenton. You're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. This is James Bartley. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to the Cosmic Switchboard, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.